Chapter 6. We went back with Alec for several days after that to mend and build up the fence along our southwest sheep pastures, making it clear to the shepherds on the other side that we knew every stone of those walls and would be aware if one were moved. Along on the third or fourth day of the work, a group of horsemen came towards us up the long falling pastures below the Little Shear, land that had been the Corda domain and now was Drummond. Sheep trotted away from the riders, blatting hoarsely. The men rode straight at us, their pace increasing as the hilltop leveled. It was a low, misty day. We were sodden with the fine rain that drifted over the hills, and dirty from handling the wet and muddy stones.
"Oh, by the stone, that's the old adder himself," Alec muttered.
My father shot him a glance that silenced him, and spoke out in a quiet, clear voice as the horsemen cantered right up to the wall.
"A good day to you, Branter Auger."
All three of us eyed their horses with admiration, for they were fine creatures. The Branter rode a beautiful honey-colored mare who looked too delicate for his bulk. Auger Drum was a man of about 60, barrel-girthed and bull-necked. He wore the black kilt and coat, but of fine woven wool, not felt, and his horse's bridle was silver-mounted. His bare calves bulged with muscle. I saw them mostly, and little of his face, because I did not want to look up into his eyes. All my life I had heard ill of Branter Auger, and the way he had ridden straight at us as if in assault, reining in hard just short of the wall, was not reassuring.
"Mending your sheep fence, Caspro?"
he said in a big, unexpectedly warm and jovial voice.
"A good job, too. I have some men good at laying dry stone. I'll send them up to help you."
"We're just finishing up today, but I thank you," Cannock said.
"I'll send them up anyhow. Fences have two sides, eh?"
"That they do," my father said.
He spoke pleasantly, though his face was as hard as the stone in his hand.
"One of these lads is yours, eh?"
Auger said, surveying Alec and me. The insult was subtle. He certainly knew that Cannock's son was a boy, not a man of 20. The implication was that there was no way to tell a Caspro son from a Caspro serf, or so we three took it.
"He is," my father said, and did not name or introduce or even look at me.
"Now that our lands border," said Auger, "I've had it in mind to come invite you and your lady to visit us at Drummond. If I rode by your house in a day or two, you'd be there?"
"I will," Cannock said. "You are welcome to come."
"Good, good. I'll be by."
Auger raised his hand in a careless, genial salute, wheeled his mare standing, and led his little troop off at a canter along the wall.
"Ah," said Alec with a sigh. "That's a sweet little yellow mare."
He was as thorough a horseman as my father. The two of them longed and schemed to improve our stable. If we could put Branty to her in a year or two, what a colt that might be.
"And what a price it would carry," Cannock said harshly.
He was tense and often sullen from that day on. He told my mother to make ready for Auger's visit, and of course she did so. Then they waited. Cannock did not go far from the stone house, not wanting her to have to receive Auger alone. It was a half month before he came. He brought the same retinue with him, men of his and other lineages of his domain, no women. My father, in his stiff pride, took that, too, as an insult. He did not let it pass.
"I'm sorry your wife did not ride with you," he said.
Auger then made apologies and excuses, saying his wife was much burdened with household cares and had been in ill health.
"But she looks forward to welcoming you to Drummond," he said, turning to Mella. "In the old days there was far more riding about and visiting from domain to domain. We've let our old upland customs of cordiality lapse. It's a different matter down in the cities, no doubt, where you have neighbors all about you thick as crows on carrion, as they say."
"Very different," my mother said meekly,
eclipsed by his loud voice and big looming body, which seemed always to contain a repressed threat.
"And this would be your lad I saw the other day," he said suddenly, turning on me. "Kadard, is it?"
"Oryk," my mother said, since I was voiceless, though I managed a duck of the head.
"Well, look up, Oryk, let me see your face," the big voice said. "Afraid of the drum eye, are you?"
He laughed again. My heart was beating at the top of my chest, hard enough to choke me, but I made myself hold my head up and look into the big face that hung over me. Auga's eyes were barely visible under heavy, drooping lids. From those creases and pouches they stared out steady and empty as a snake's eyes.
"And you've shown your gift, I hear."
He glanced at my father.
Alec, of course, had told everybody on our domain about the adder. And it's amazing how fast word travels from place to place in the uplands, where it seems that nobody speaks to anybody but their closest kin, and not often to them.
"He has," Kanuk said, looking at me, not Auga.
"So it ran true in spite of everything," Auga said in such a warm, congratulatory tone that I could not believe he intended the blatant insult to my mother. "The undoing. Now that's a power I'd like to see. We have only woman of the Caspro line at Drummond, as you know. They carry the gift, of course, but can't show it. Maybe young Oryk here will give us a demonstration. Would you like that, lad?"
The big voice was genial, pressing. Refusal was not possible. I said nothing, but in courtesy had to make some response. I nodded.
"Good, then we'll round up some serpents for you before you come, eh? Or you can clear some of the rats and kittens out of our old barn, if you like. I'm glad to know the gift runs true." This to my father with the same booming geniality. "For I've had a thought concerning a granddaughter of mine, my youngest son's daughter, which we might talk about when you come to Drummond."
He rose.
"Now you've seen I'm not so much an ogre as maybe you've been told."
This to my mother.
"You'll do us the honor of a visit, will you, in May, when the roads are dry?"
"With pleasure, sir," Mella said, rising also, and she bowed her head above her hands crossed at the fingertips, a lowland gesture of polite respect, entirely foreign to us. Auga stared at her. It was as if the gesture had made her visible to him. Before that he had not really looked at any of us. She stood there respectful and aloof. Her beauty was unlike that of any upland woman, a fineness of bone, a quickness, a subtle vigor. I saw his big face change, growing heavy with emotions I could not read. Amazement? Envy? Hunger? Hate? He called to his companions, who had been gathered around the table my mother had set for them. They went out to their horses in the courtyard, and all went jangling off. My mother looked at the ruins of the feast. "They ate well," she said, with a hostess's pride, but also ruefully, for there was nothing left at all for us of the delicacies she had, with much care and work provided.
"Like crows on carrion," Kanuk quoted very dryly.
She gave a little laugh. "He's not a diplomat," she said.
"I don't know what he is, or why he came."
"It seems he came about Oryk." My father glanced at me, but I stood planted there, determined to hear.
"Maybe," he said, clearly trying to defer the discussion at least until I should not be there to hear it.
My mother had no such scruples. "Was he talking of betrothal?"
"The girl would be of the right age."
"Oryk's not 14.
"She'd be a little younger. 12 or 13. But a Caspro through her mother, you see."
"Two children betrothed to marry?"
"It's nothing uncommon," Kanuk said, his tone getting stiff. "It would be troth only. There'd be no marriage for years."
"It's far too young for any kind of arrangement."
"It can be best to have these things secure and known. A great deal rides on a marriage."
I won't hear of it, she said quietly, shaking her head. Her tone was not defiant at all, but she did not often declare opposition, and it may have driven my father, tense as he was, farther than he would otherwise have gone. I don't know what Drum wants, but if he proposes a betrothal, it's a generous offer, and one we must consider. There is no other girl of the true Caspero lineage in the West. Canuck looked at me, and I could not help but think of how he looked at colts and fillies, with that thoughtful, appraising gaze, seeing what might come of it. Then he turned away and said, I only wonder why he should propose it. Maybe he means it as a compensation. Mella stared. I had to think it out. Did he mean compensation for the three women he might have married to keep his lineage true, the women Aga had snatched away, driving him in defiance to go and get himself a bride who was of no lineage at all? My mother went red, redder than I had ever seen her, so that the clear brown of her skin was dark as a winter sunset. She said carefully, Have you been expecting compensation? Canuck could be as dense as stone. It would be just, he said. It could mend some fences. He paced down the room. Darrodin wasn't an old woman, not too old to bear Seb Drum this daughter. He paced back to us and stood looking down, pondering. We must consider the offer, if he makes it. Drum is an evil enemy. He might be a good friend. If it's friendship he offers, I must take it. And the chance for Auric is better than I could hope. Mella said nothing. She had stated her opposition, and there was nothing else to say. If the practice of betrothing children was new and distasteful to her, the principle of making a good marriage for one's child, the use of marriage for financial and social advantage, was perfectly familiar to her. And in these matters of the amity and enmity between domains and the maintenance of a lineage, she was the foreigner, the outsider, who must trust my father's knowledge and judgment. But I had some ideas of my own, and with my mother there on my side, I spoke out. But if I got betrothed to that girl at Drummond, I said, what about Gry? Canuck and Mella both turned and looked at me. What about Gry? Canuck said, with an uncharacteristic pretense of stupidity. If Gry and I wanted to get betrothed... You're far too young, my mother burst out, and then saw where that took her. My father stood silent for some while. Turnock and I have talked of this, he said, speaking doggedly, heavily, sentence by sentence. Gry is of a great line, and strong in her gift. Her mother wishes her to be betrothed to Anrin Bera of Cordemont, to keep the lineage true. Nothing has been decided, but this girl at Drummond is of our line, Auric. That's a matter of very great weight to me, to you, to our people. It's a chance we cannot throw away. Drum is our neighbor now, and kinship is a way to friendship. We and Rodmont have always been friends, I said, standing my ground. I don't discount that. He stood gazing at the despoiled table, undecided for all his decisive speech. Let it be for now, he said at last. Drum may have meant nothing at all. He blows hot and cold at once. We'll go there in May and know better what's at stake. It may be I misunderstood him. He is a coarse man, but he seemed to mean to be friendly, Mella said. Coarse was as harsh a word as she used of anyone. It meant she disliked him very much, but she was uncomfortable with distrust, which had not come naturally to her. By seeing goodwill where there was none, often enough she had created it. The people of the household worked with and for her with willing hearts. The sullenest farmers spoke to her cordially, and tight-mouthed old serf women would confide their sorrows to her as to a sister. I couldn't wait to go see Gry and talk with her about the visit. I had been kept close to the house while we waited on Aga's whim, but usually I was free to go where I pleased, once the work was done. So in the afternoon of the next day,
I told my mother I was riding over to Rodmont. She looked at me with her clear eyes, and I blushed, but she said nothing. I asked my father if I could take the red colt. I felt an unusual assurance as I spoke to him. He had seen me show the gift of our lineage, and heard me spoken of as a potential bridegroom. It didn't surprise me when he said I could ride the colt. Without reminding me to keep him from shying at cattle, and to walk him after I let him run, as he would have reminded me when I was a boy of 13, instead of a man of 13.